Our second case for this morning is Batson v. Live Nation Entertainment. Mr. Langone.
Good morning, members of the court. Chris Langone on behalf of the plaintiff appellant James Batson. We are here today. We believe that the district court erred in holding that Mr. Batson did not state a claim. First, we believe that under the pleading standard in Windy City, which is a Rule 8 standard for unfairness claims, that Mr. Batson clearly stated a claim with respect to Live Nation's practice of imposing a $9 parking fee on all tickets purchased for the Charter One Pavilion in Chicago, regardless of whether consumers want parking or not.
$9 covered both elements, did it not?
Both elements of?
Well, it admitted you to the concert and gave you parking, right?
No, it was on top of the ticket price. The ticket had its face value of whatever, $30, $25, whatever the artist would negotiate. And then on top of that, there was a $9 fee that was written on the ticket. It just said PRKPD. Which was subsequently learned to mean parking paid.
Did you at any point argue to the district court that the practice of charging for parking was deceptive in that it was not disclosed to purchasers at the box office or over, the Internet until after the non-refundable ticket was purchased?
Yes. And paragraph 67 of the complaint, which is on page A27 of the record attached to the opening brief, says the forced parking purchase is unfair because the amount of the parking charge is not disclosed up front.
You're saying to me that in answer to my question, that the $9 is the amount that the sellers assigned to parking. They didn't collect $9 separately from the ticket.
They collected it.
That was just a number that they put on the parking arrangement. Isn't that right?
They charged each consumer. Basically, they charged every concert goer $9 for parking.
Well, they didn't charge them.
Right.
They just stamped the ticket $9 paid.
So the point is, if the ticket was $60, just for the sake of argument, you didn't have the choice of buying a $51 ticket. That's your whole point. You don't like the $60 price, but as Judge Cudahy is saying, you paid $60 for the ticket. They could have stamped $5 and attributed $55 to the ticket. They could have stamped $9 and attributed $51. They could have stamped, $15 and attributed $45. But he paid, in my hypothetical, $60 to go to the concert, and he doesn't like the goods and services that went along with that $60.
I don't think it's a question of the goods and services that went along with the
$60. Precisely is. What's the difference between your case and if I go shopping at North Michigan Avenue and I park in the garage there, I can show my receipt and get a discount on parking in the garage that's there. So, instead of paying $20, maybe I pay $10 for parking. And some people who shop at North Michigan Avenue, 900 North, don't park at all. They walk up there, they take a cab, just like your client. And so they're not getting that $10 benefit for the parking. So are you saying that the practice of the 900 North Michigan Avenue stores is similarly illegal?
Oh, no, because, first of all, they're not getting the benefit of the $10 discount, but they're not being forced to pay $10.
No, they aren't. What if they own the parking garage?
Nobody paid $10 or $9. That's my only point. They just stamped it on a piece of paper.
Well, it's part of the it's separate and apart from the face value of the ticket. It's first of all, it's not charged at all.
You pay the money for the ticket, right?
Correct.
That's the end of the transaction. Somebody gives you part of the ticket back and stamps it $9.
Right, and this is where it becomes...
That isn't paying $9.
Well, it's...
Semantics of the situation, anyway.
Is it any different than an airline including a charge for two bags in the cost of the ticket, regardless of whether the flyer brings any bags? I mean, if that airline is the only one in a particular city that flies to your destination, how is the choice that the flyer would face materially different from the choice that the concert goer faces here?
So this is the difference between anti-competitive tie-ins or bundling and pro-consumer bundling. So, for instance, if you give someone a choice of a side dish and you bundle that with a meal in a competitive market,
that's answer Judge Rovner's question.
There's no separate market for sending bags.
Oh, yes, there is.
Apart from...
Oh, boy. Welcome to 2013.
Airlines will let you send the bags entirely separately.
Sure.
As you undoubtedly know, if you're not a premier flyer, some airlines charge you the $25 for your bag. Some airlines, Southwest, bundle it into the price of the ticket. Yeah. So if you fly Southwest from here to Houston, you get two bags, whether you have nothing but a satchel over your shoulder or two enormous bags.
First of all, that's a competitive market. Secondly, if they charge you for bags and then
Are you saying this isn't a competitive market?
The Live Nation ticketing market? No, Live Nation and Ticketmaster have a monopoly on the primary event.
You assert
ticketing.
That in your brief, but I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case.
We talk about their control of the amphitheater venues. We talk about their control
that's
of ticketing. There's a lot of allegations in the complaint, but I do want to address
example. Hold up. The basis of the tie-in as an antitrust violation is you have to have monopoly power in one commodity or one object, and you transfer it to another one through the tie-in. That's why we have the rule in the first place, which has been widely criticized, I might add. But that's the rule. And you assert in your brief that somehow you're sponsoring a concert, and somehow you have monopoly power. I don't follow that at all.
It's monopoly power over the summer amphitheater, which is outdoor summer concerts. But if I can get back
here's the problem. You're trying to have it both ways. You say repeatedly in your brief, this is not an antitrust case. You're not trying to meet the requirements of the antitrust laws. You're foregoing treble damages. Fine. But you are making an antitrust kind of argument when you say there's market power in this market. The district court took you at your word, didn't go through the sometimes rigorous process of defining what the market is for the tying product. You know, there are a lot of things that might be said about that, but that process was never undertaken, and I don't see anything on this complaint that makes me think yay or nay as to whether there's market power. You just don't like the fact that this ticket has not only the right to sit in a chair and watch OAR do their concert, but also includes, for those who wish it, the right to park a car. Wishes it, but some do.
And to get back again to Judge Rovner's example of the bags, if there were not enough, if they charged you for the bags and then there were not enough spaces in the overhead compartments to allow you, which is, again, a very important part of our allegations, that they charge. They only have 2,500 spots,
speculation that anybody was ever turned away for lack of a parking place, just as, you know, the airlines study how much space they need to allocate when they have an airplane full of people. They know that not everybody's going to come on with two bags, but they make exactly the same calculation. You don't say anyone was ever turned away for parking. You just say X number of people bought tickets and there are only one-third X parking places, and therefore there's a problem.
Is it an unfair practice to sell more tickets than you have available? I mean, that becomes...
The demand is. Suppose, you know, they have a backup plan that if somebody shows up and the parking lot's full, on a complimentary basis. They valet it somewhere else.
We could suppose that, and maybe if this had gotten to the summary judgment stage, we could have some evidence on that, and I do contend that that is a very serious error that the judge made. I mean, even the Siegel case, which in preparing for this argument, I listened to the argument in that case. Judge St. Eve in that case denied the 12B6 motion and then granted summary judgment, and this court affirmed. That was a gas oil price fixing case where the consumer said that all the gas companies conspired to raise the price of gasoline, and one of the facts that came out was that the consumer, Mr. Siegel, could have gone to other elsewhere. We did not get the opportunity to develop a factual record, and I think rather on that basis alone, we might be back here in 2 or 3 years, but that on that basis alone, I hope not, but I see my rebuttal time as I'd like to reserve the balance.
That for your rebuttal time. Mr. Berkowitz.
May it please the court, I'm Sean Berkowitz here on behalf of the Live Nation Appellees. This court had it exactly right. Mr. Batson's problem is that he was forced to pay for something that he says he doesn't want. The district court at the initial presentment hearing asked the exact same questions that you had for Mr. Langone, and he didn't have an answer. He was asked why this is different than an airline, why it's different than a two-drink minimum at a club, and his answer was essentially that it's a violation of the Consumer Fraud Act to charge somebody for goods and services they don't want, period. If they said the price of 3 beers in every ticket, three free drinks, and you didn't want a drink, that would be deceptive. You just can't bundle up a bunch of products and force people. We contend that is a violation. That is,
I have two questions for you, Mr. Berkowitz. One is just idle curiosity on my part, which I didn't dig out, which is what the actual face price of this ticket was.
The face price, the amount that was paid as attached to the first complaint was $45.50, and that included, quote, $9 PRK paid.
The stamp on it said $9
PRK paid.
All right, so my other question actually goes back to paragraph 67 of the complaint, which we've been referred to. I take it that the website and other sources do disclose that there will be a charge for parking, but they don't disclose what the amount will be. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I read this.
Paragraph 83 of the complaint says, defendants state on their website, quote, parking is available at the Soldier Field Garage, which is included in the price of each ticket. Similar statements are made on Live Nation's website at each of the relevant venues. It does not specify how much.
Now, would our analysis be the same? This is a $9 parking charge, which, having lived in Chicago all these years, doesn't strike me as a wild parking charge. Suppose the ticket was a $90 ticket, and it had stamped on the ticket $45 for parking. Is that the same case as this one?
I think that it might not be. The third element under substantial harm might be a little different, but I would suggest the outcome would be the same. And the reason for that, Judge, is that Mr. Batson, when faced with that, would decide whether he wanted to pay $90 to go see the concert or not. If he wanted to pay $90, he would have paid it, and it was worth that to him. He could have walked away. There's no suggestion that he was forced into the concert and couldn't leave the venue before he paid the amount. He had the choices. Judge Rovner.
No, you finish your thought. I'm gathering my strength.
Okay. he had a meaningful alternative here to not purchase the ticket. There's no constitutional or statutory right to see this particular band on that particular night. And if they had charged $90 and said free parking, I think the analysis would be the same. It's just
that I'm not worried about. From the Consumer Fraud Act point of view, if you charge $90 and the parking, let's just assume hypothetically that you don't usually pay $45 for parking in Chicago, although I think you actually can somewhere, but that makes it seem like, you know, charging $45 for something that a great number of people don't want over on Northerly Island, it's very easy to get to Northerly Island, strikes me as closer to the mark where maybe you're taking unfair advantage of people somehow, or you're exploiting whatever leverage you have over the concert's existence.
Now, how much leverage do you have in your view? How much market power do you exercise?
Judge, the complaint certainly doesn't suggest anything or give any details on it. In terms of the amount of market power, we have a venue and we have a band. If somebody wants to come see it, they can make a determination whether the price is something that they're comfortable with. There's no compulsion or coercion that they have to see this. We're also not in the parking market. There are no allegations that the $45 or the $9 charge actually goes to Live Nation. The complaint says that the parking venue is owned by the Park District, and there are no allegations regarding whether we're benefiting from that.
Now, the district court indicated that there are other music options for Mr. Babson. But is music fungible such that any other band could be substituted? Should the question be whether there's any other way for Mr. Batson to see this particular band?
Perhaps metaphysically, yes, but legally, no, Your Honor. The Rentgrove case, the Garrett versus Rentgrove case, speaks directly to this issue. There was a woman who wanted subsidized housing in the Continental Apartments, which were her, quote, ideal apartment. They were the price she wanted, the location that she wanted. And she was denied the right to go there because of a mistake by Rentgro in evaluating her application. And she sued under the Illinois, under ICFA. And the court there held that although the Continental may be her ideal, she could have gone to a different apartment.
Now, there are a number of antitrust cases that go in the opposite direction. And I'm thinking, for example, of the international boxing case. I'm thinking of the NCAA case in 1984. And a line of cases that has recognized that copyrighted material, for example, as I'm sure OAR's songs are, has at least some distinctive power in the market. It's not that you can't substitute one movie for another, but there are a bunch of old movie cases in the antitrust laws as well that suggest, you know, if you want to go see Argo, you don't really want to go see, you know, a Disney film. You don't want to go see Aladdin. There is some distinctiveness with OAR that's not the same, I think, as the apartment market or the other markets.
Understood, although the case law that talks about no meaningful alternative here really is a far cry. It's not even close to what we're talking about with respect.
Do the OAR people really want to go see the Chicago Symphony instead?
I you never know, Judge. I like both alternative and classical. But
what's the elasticity of demand for bands?
He could have sat on the lawn outside Northerly Island and listened to it and not paid and gone in. He could have bought a CD and listened to the band. He could have watched them on YouTube. There are a number of places where he could get his OAR fix without having to be outside under the lights within the confines of the stadium. But here we have to analyze this case under the three-pronged Speary test with respect to whether there's a public policy and whether there was a meaningful alternative. And the case law on the meaningful alternative, Your Honors, is clear. The types of cases where there is oppressiveness found are, for example, the Echo case, where plumbing had been installed, price hadn't been discussed, the woman is charged three times the standard amount. She says she doesn't want to pay, and the plumber says, well, I'm going to rip out the plumbing that I did and turn off your water. That was found to constitute oppressiveness. The Wentworth case, I believe.
Because everyone hates plumbers.
That's true, Your Honor. And
the website had not disclosed even that parking would be included. I'm still worried, actually, with the statute that we have before us, the Consumer Fraud Act. Where you think the line is when conduct becomes deceptive or misleading?
So, Your Honor, there were certainly the website existed. There was articles about it, apparently, at least as alleged in the complaint. And he was able to know exactly what he was paying for this concert. I think we're all in agreement.
He doesn't find out until the ticket's handed across the transom to him. And at that point, stamped on the ticket is a very large legend that says this is non-refundable. So he didn't have the option, he alleges, and seems reasonable enough, to give the ticket back to them and say, oh, you know, I didn't know that this $9 parking was in there, and my reservation price for OAR concerts wasn't $45. It was $45 minus $9, $36. And so I don't want this ticket. And he alleges they would have said, no, you're stuck with the ticket. You bought it.
Understood, Your Honor. He knew exactly the price that he was paying before he got the ticket. Either he signed the credit card or he paid cash for it. And so he knew it was $45. He could have looked beforehand to determine what the price of the ticket is. On the website, it says parking is included in the price of the ticket.
But nowhere do you allege the number $9. That's the thing. He doesn't know that he's wasting $9 of his dollars when he buys this ticket.
And I wouldn't suggest he's wasting it. He's just not using the service. He's getting the value for what he bargained for, just like somebody who flies on an airline but doesn't eat the peanuts or doesn't check a bag is getting the bargain, just like somebody who doesn't want to drink is getting the bargain. It's a perfectly appropriate business practice, and instead what he's essentially asking for us to do is to charge $45.50 for the ticket and say free parking, not break it up.
Does Live Nation have to pay a fee to the parking garage to reserve spots for the customers regardless of whether those spots are used?
The record is silent as to that issue, Your Honor. The talks about there being arrangements between the two, but there's nothing in the record on that. Nor do I think at the end of the day it ought to be material to this case on these facts under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, because this particular plaintiff is getting exactly what he bargained for. He's not using an add-on that was available. Certain people are using it. He's not. It was not oppressive, and it doesn't offend. Certainly, you know, this is a guy who filed an antitrust claim, didn't have standing, wasn't able to prove the allegations, and essentially attempted to bring the same deficient allegations under what he assumed was a more permissive standard. That failed, and he's now here asking this court to substitute his own personal preferences and whims for how we should market the ticket, how we should stamp the ticket, and upend, essentially, Illinois law. If we were to follow what Mr. Langone and Mr. Batson are asking this court to do, we would be before you for any number of common practices that are clearly appropriate, and it would really be a huge enhancement and expansion of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, which is designed really to be a remedial statute. He could have fled.
Paragraph 68, that Business Insider, he cites his website, describes your practice as sneaky.
And I think that's from a press.
It is, businessinsider.com.
Business Insider, yeah. Immoral, understood, Your Honor.
I don't know. I mean, you know, there. Well,
one thing that I found, you know, not very attractive is that you don't even, you know, possess enough parking spaces to fulfill the number of parking spots that are sold in this manner. That kind of
rubs you the wrong way.
Rubbed me a bit.
And there's no allegation. First of all, this particular plaintiff didn't drive, and so he didn't face that situation, nor is there any allegation that there were any people who didn't get parking spaces. What I would also say is that there is a deception prong under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act that they could have argued but chose not to. They chose to proceed under the unfairness element. There's a heightened pleading standard under the deceptive practice prong. They chose not to do that. They threw an allegation in there, the one that he pointed you to, but if that was the gravamen of his complaint, one would have expected him to proceed under that theory. The proposed imputative class here is a class of people who were forced to pay parking that they didn't want, not, and that's in paragraph 86 6. It's not a putative class of people who were deceived by the parking charge. So while this practice may not be something that everybody agrees is the ideal, it certainly does not run afoul of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Langone?
Although this might have been filed as a putative class, the court never reached it because it dismissed the claim before a full factual record could be developed. Mr. Batson never purchased through the website. As we allege, he walked up to the will call window. It was not disclosed in advance. There was no sign saying your ticket includes $9.
Did the allegations include the information whether after this unpleasant surprise Mr. Batson actually went to the concert or not? Or did he turn on his heel and walk back home?
He did go. I'll represent. He did go to the concert. But, again, there was no disclosure. Even if there was a disclosure on the website, maybe if we try to certify a class, if this court reverses, that might become a question of the certifiability of the class. As to Mr. Batson's individual consumer fraud claim, the uncontested allegation is there was no advance disclosure at all.
That's why the real issue is whether within the confines of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, where is the line? You concede that businesses can and do package goods and services together every day. And I think you would be willing to agree that sometimes those packages are legal and sometimes those packages cross over a line of illegality. We know one line of illegality is the one understood in the antitrust laws, where there's enough market power over the tying product to restrain a substantial amount of commerce in the tied product market. You're not worried about the parking market. You're worried about the original tying product market. And there really isn't much law, as opposed to a couple of law review articles, that suggests that there's anything wrong if you have the market power, whatever it may be, over the product or service that you're selling, for you to set a price that people are willing to pay for it.
What we allege, again, this is a fact-intensive inquiry. We allege this is the case, right? We allege that, for instance, one reason Jam Productions, one reason they don't say $45.50 includes free parking is because that would be the ticket price. They would have to remit a percentage of that to the artist. But what they do is they promise certain artists more than 110% of the ticket price.
You have standing to complain about that.
That interferes with meaningful consumer choice, which is the policy.
It's not consumer choice. If anybody's hurt, it's the artists.
Which, competition.
That's your next case.
That's the point. Competition is hurt. And the other thing is we didn't get an opportunity to develop a record of whether there were complaints about insufficient parking spaces because the judge erroneously sent the case out on a motion to dismiss. And, of course, oppression is not the be-all, end-all to the Sperry test. That's one way you can get up that hill, but you can also prove that the harms to consumers are substantially outweighed by the benefits, which would seem a very apropos question in bundling. Do the benefits of bundling, are they outweighed by the harms to competition? Certainly we could get some expert testimony on that point. We were deprived of the opportunity to develop that. Maybe Professor Grimes.
There's another question here. This is a federal court, of course. And there's a fair amount of law that says federal courts in interpreting this kind of a state statute should not extend it. They should leave that to the states to do that, state courts to do that.
And they, yeah.
What do you have to say to
and
that?
And not only not extend it, but not narrow
your
it.
Your opponent just told us this was a vast extension of
that. That's wrong.
State law.
Direct the court to footnote 5 in FTC v. Sperry v. Hutchinson, where the court specifically held that whether the practice, without necessarily having been previously considered unlawful, offends public policy as been established by the statutes, common law, or otherwise, or is within the penumbra of some common law policy of unfairness, is immoral, unethical, oppressive, or unscrupulous, or causes substantial injury to consumers, competitors, or other businesses. And that's the Sperry test that the Supreme Court adopted in Robinson. Supreme Court adopted that in Robinson. This case should have been up here on a summary judgment record. It was an error to dismiss it on 12b-6. Windy City is dispositive. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.